Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line One, your health connection on KSKA Anchorage. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. Our topic today is going to be the newest recommendations of the United States Preventive Services Task Force on prostate screening. About the time that came out this past May, Warren Buffett, who is, I believe, 61, maybe 68, 80. Oh, that's right, he's 80-something, had a PSA test that indicated that he should be screened further, and I think had a biopsy. So that was not something that was recommended according to the new guidelines. And that made me want to discuss this further for those men out there who are maybe somewhat confused about where things stand. And so today I have Laura Newman, who is joining us by telephone. Laura is a New York-based medical reporter, writer, and editor. She specializes in clinical medicine, new drugs, and diagnostics, as well as health policy. She's had experience writing on oncology or cancer problems, imaging, neurology, and other targeted therapies. She's, as well, for about a year, managed the urology blog at the website about.com, and she has a blog called patientpov.org she writes extensively about issues such as this. She's joining us by telephone, as I said, and in the studio today is Dr. Clark. Bill Clark is a urologist here in Anchorage. He's been with me a couple of times in the past. He's a graduate of the Air Force Academy and then got his medical degree at Chicago Medical School. I went on to get his urology training at the Mayo Clinic, and after spending some time with the Air Force, opened and started private practice at the Alaska Urological Institute in about 1989. So I want to say first thanks to both of you for your willingness to come on and talk about this. Laura and Bill, thanks again.
You're welcome.
Yeah, thank you.
So I guess the way I would suggest we start about this, let's learn a little bit about the United States Preventive Forces Task Force and a little bit about prostate cancer and PSA testing. And Laura, if you wouldn't mind, tell us a little bit about this task force and who the members are and their purpose and how they go about coming up with recommendations.
Well, as I understand it, the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force is an independent panel of experts in prevention, evidence-based medicine. They know how to read studies, and they review preventive services, for example, screening, people who are asymptomatic, you know, basically normal. Can you prevent cancer? Can you find diabetes in somebody who wouldn't have it? That kind of thing. And they'll do screening, counseling, and even preventive medications. And generally, these people have a really solid research background, and they tend not to be connected to the service that is being reviewed. And that's an added portion of that, although that is now coming up for debate.
Yeah.
I think specialists do want to join in, and there are some House bills to change that.
Yeah, so they're trying to take some potential, as much bias out of it by, you know, not, you know, one of the arguments was is there's no urologists on, and the argument would be, well, the urologist may have a bias one way or the other about these, so that what you're saying is that the composition of this committee did not include a urologist, and that may have been good.
Right. I think it can go all kinds of ways. I mean, in fact, there's an article, there's a blog up this morning on, I think it's Health News Review, talking about transparency, and I kind of argued with the blogger, but, you know, some people think this is a terrible, terrible idea to bring urologists in, and, you know, others are more willing to have them on board if, you know, they don't take over the proceedings.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, it really depends on how dogmatic people might be.
Mm-hmm.
In looking at evidence and that sort of thing. And you know, things like transparency, commercial involvement, that might preclude being a dispassionate member of the task force.
Right. And this is the same task force that has given recommendations on mammograms and other preventative services with the idea that what do we know the best right now about often risks and benefits of these kinds of services. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct.
The other thing I guess I would throw in is my understanding, and Bill, you jump in if I don't say this right, but I think the information that they get is already had another opinion. I mean, the information that they're using, the studies they're using, have been pulled from another contractor, usually university experts, which in this case, I don't know whether that included urologists or not. That information is gathered, then given to the task force to look at. So that information is already had some vetting as to what is really good science, what's the appropriate, what should the task force look at. And then I think the task force often renders a very similar judgment, but they're the ones that finally put the stamp on it. Is that true also? Do you guys understand that?
Well, at least the articles are certainly peer-reviewed, mm-hmm. and so they do have the input in that sense from whoever those peer reviewers are, mm-hmm. and that varies by study and by publication as well.
Okay.
You know, I just wanted to throw out on a related note, on the national level, there was a National Institutes of Health consensus development panel that met last fall addressing the concept of active surveillance. Is this safe? Is this harmful? And that was also controversial, but when that panel convened in Bethesda, urologists and all kinds of people spoke.
Okay. All right. So we've got a little bit of background of where these recommendations are coming from. They're ideally the best science, and not all science is perfect. There are always issues within any study, so they've reviewed the best. They've tried to be as impartial as they can. They tried to come up with their best recommendations. But there may be some problems that are worth discussing, and that relates a little bit to understanding prostate cancer and PSA. I'm going to go ahead. It's best to go ahead and read the specific recommendation, very short. And then, Bill, let me let you tell us what a PSA is, and then maybe a little bit about prostate cancer. So their specific recommendation is that task force recommends against PSA-based screening for prostate cancer. That doesn't mean it can't be used or not. They're not even addressing the issue about surveillance after a diagnosis or using it or during treatment to estimate how well treatment may be going. So this is just for screening. So Bill, what is a PSA? And then tell us a little bit about prostate cancers.
Well, PSA stands for prostate-specific antigen, and it's a protein that's actually quite good for looking at the pathologies within a prostate, whether it just be prostate enlargement, and actually it's much more representative of just big prostates versus small prostates, because what the reality is it's only made in prostate cancer or prostate cells, whether they be cancer or non-cancer. So the higher your PSA, the more prostate cells you have, or the more abnormal cells you have, and the most abnormal being a prostate cancer cell. So the idea with and the basis for all the studies that were really reviewed by the task force were based on an elevated level. And that is somewhat problematic, because trying to determine what a normal level is, for example, the U.S. Study and the two studies that they based on, one European and one U.S. studies, the U.S. study used 4.0. The European study used 3.5 as being their breakpoint between normal and abnormal. And that has been just a real troublesome kind of factor as well.
And my understanding is it generally a PSA goes up with age anyway. I'm overstating it because I'm not perfect on it, but I wanted to wonder if that makes it difficult to draw a line in the sand.
Exactly. And it also goes up based on how large the prostate is. So
okay.
In some families have a tendency to have big prostates, and they'll have a family that has an earlier rise in PSA. But typically, as you age, the prostate gets bigger, and if the prostate gets bigger, your PSA is going to going to slide upwards.
There's a couple of factors that may determine outside of the fact whether there's a cancer or not, an infection or injury.
Oh, absolutely. Injury, trauma, any kind of inflammatory response.
Okay. All right. So now, you know, we've kind of been talking on this program for the last several years that not all cancers are the same, and even all breast cancers aren't the same, and I'm thinking all prostate cancers are not the same.
Absolutely. That's one of the other problems, is to be essentially lumping all prostate cancer into one category makes it very difficult, and we're definitely finding out that some tumors are much more aggressive than others, and the problematic issue is trying to determine one from the other. And it's very similar, actually, if you look at breast cancer and prostate cancer. The breast cancer research is about 5 to 8 years ahead of prostate cancer research, and they are very similar in their biology and how they respond often to treatment. So what we're finding is the case in breast cancer, and different markers, different targets, is coming to be the case in prostate cancer as well.
All right. Let me remind listeners, you're listening to Line 1, your health connection. Our topic today is the recent National Public Health Service Task Force recommendations on not recommending PSA-based screening for prostate cancer, and that's regardless of age, incidentally. And my guests are Laura Newman, a reporter in New York City who is well experienced with this kind of issue and the literature on it, and Bill Clark, a urologist. Dr. Clark is in the office, studio with me, and Laura Newman is joining us by telephone. For those of you who are listening, if you've got questions or comments, there's a couple of ways to get a hold of us. Our local number, 550-8433. That's 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. And let me remind everyone who's listening, if you go to alaskapublic.org, go to the Line 1 link. There are several links there that may be mentioned in the program, including a link to the U.S., the national, these guidelines, how to get a hold of Bill Clark's office, and also Laura Newman's contact information, and particularly her blog. Let me finish this recommendation. So the recommendation was that they recommended against PSA screening for prostate cancer. And they gave it a D recommendation, which in their terms means that they really firmly are against it because there is a moderate or high certainty that the service that is doing the PSA screening has no net benefit, or that the harms outweigh the benefits. And we've often stressed on the program that any treatment, you've got to consider risks and benefits. And basically they're saying here that the evidence for benefit is not great enough to outweigh the harms. And that's where the rubber meets the road, and there's some disagreement among experts. Laura, your comments at this point.
Well, I think one thing that's interesting is if you look at international data and even international, you know, point of view of patients, I know that in the UK there was a trial where they randomized men into active monitoring versus radical prostatectomy, radical radiation therapy. Now, that such a trial could never have happened in the U.S. because we're so entrenched in treatment and swatting things that PSA kind of caught on in the late 80s. And it was just seen as this amazing serum test that picked up all these cancers, and men were living longer. And it's kind of, you know, PSA screening is not embraced in the UK, for example. And I think that other countries really want to see data before they embrace something like this, because it's not just the test. It's a whole cascade that follows. Biopsies, a large proportion are negative, and then you get these repeat biopsies, you get the cancer diagnosis, you know, men are treated, you know, how, you know, what are the health outcomes, and, you know, it sort of goes on and on. And I think now what's sort of come home to roost is that we're kind of beginning to see the outcomes, way after the late 80s. So, I mean, I guess my inclination is to think that the widespread screening may have been a mistake, and that men should be should learn all the possibilities.
Right.
You know, the uncertainties and the benefits and possible downsides.
Right. Right. In fact, pretty much that's what the guidelines go on to say, is that it's really important that the individual being screened, and I'm again kind of quoting from a comment from the co-chair of this committee, the individual being screened understands what is known about PSA screening and makes personal decision that even a small possibility of benefit outweighs the known risk of harms, end quote. The harms, I think maybe I should go ahead and ferret out. And then I want to ask Bill, who's been around long enough to see what appears to be significant benefits from PSA screening in cancer. And I think we need to get back to that perspective as well. But here are the risk-benefit kind of ratio that the task force came up with. And again, I think these calculations and things have been vetted well enough outside of even that committee. But for every 1,000 men screened, one life would be saved. Between 30 and 40 men were going to experience erectile dysfunction or incontinence from unnecessary medical treatments. Two will suffer cardiac events. One man will have a blood clot. And for every 3,000 men screened, one's going to die as a result of the surgical intervention. So given that most tumors detected by the blood test are slow growing, we haven't really discussed that as well as I wished we had. And I'll ask Bill to maybe talk about that again when we talk about the different cancers. So that most of the prostate cancers are detected by blood are slow growing. These risks do not outweigh the benefits. Bill, two things. One, there are very rapidly progressive prostate cancers that things happen very quickly. Is it true also that most of them are fairly slow growing, and that's usually felt not to be the cause of death for many, many men? And then the other thing I guess I also want to talk about is this idea, what was life like in the urology world with prostate cancer before PSA screening came around?
Well, I think those are good questions. But one thing, just getting back to the purpose of the preventive task force was supposed to be screening. And so many of the recommendations were on treatment for prostate cancer, which is really not what my understanding of the purpose was for that task force to decide on the treatment for prostate cancer. Mm-hmm. So that's a little bit of an extension over what most of them do. But at any rate, if you look at probably the first question, I would kind of delay to the second, because I think one of the things that has happened over the past 20 years, which is basically the PSA era, is that prostate cancer now is detected so much earlier than it was when we started previously without the PSA. Approximately 75 to 78% of the patients who had the diagnosis of prostate cancer were diagnosed with what we call metastatic disease, meaning it was already well outside the prostate, either in the bones, in the lymph nodes, and at that point was a much more difficult cancer to control or to treat. Today, it's under 7%. And the likelihood that things other than PSA have made that change is, to me, fairly hard to substantiate. I mean, basically, a digital rectal exam and patient symptoms are the only things that are the same, and that has not changed. So I think that's a radical difference. And if we look at the survival rate of prostate cancer presently diagnosed, it's close to 90% at 15 years, but that's when you have a prostate cancer that is found before it's metastatic. So I think that's one of the reasons why the epidemiology has shown a 40% reduction in prostate cancer deaths in the last 20 years, which is pretty remarkable with the fact that prostate cancer diagnosis has gone up. And granted, there are certainly many tumors which are less likely to lead to death. Certainly the number of patients exposed to that because of our aging population is increasing as well. And that was really not addressed, I think, in some of this task force recommendations.
What about the difference between the cancers? Laura, hang on just a second. Let's get this so that there are, and the same thing is true of breast cancer.
Exactly.
I mean, you can do a mammography and it's perfectly normal and someone could be dead within a year because they missed that that very bad metastatic disease happened right after the, or became more apparent right after the mammography.
Oh, absolutely. There are way more aggressive tumors than people realized formerly, and to be able to distinguish those has been a very difficult task. What the Europeans have actually been very good at doing is starting these surveillance trials much earlier, and we have now data to look at what happens with the natural history of these prostate cancers. And actually, one of the things that the disclaimer within the preventive task force recommendations was that once a diagnosis of prostate cancer and a management of prostate cancer, still PSA is a very valuable tool. So the Europeans actually use PSA to decide about treatment.
Mm-hmm.
And they look at what we call PSA doubling time, or how rapidly that PSA is going up, as a determining factor for distinguishing between a more aggressive or faster moving cancer and a slower moving cancer.
Mm-hmm.
We also look at the grade of these tumors under the microscope. They're actually graded on the consensus panel now is using a Gleason grading scale, mm-hmm. which typically goes from 2 to 10, with 2 being a barely cancer and a 10 being a very aggressive, fast moving cancer. There's also a new urine based, we kind of refer to it as a urine based biopsy, but it's called the prostate cancer antigen 3. It's kind of the third iteration of an actual antigen from a prostate cancer cell. The higher that level is, the more likely you have an aggressive cancer, and they use that actually as a determining factor for treatment versus non-treatment. And that's basically a very non-invasive test that's done after a digital rectal exam and avoiding specimen of urine.
Okay. Laura, I believe you were going to make a comment, and I may have cut you off there.
Well, I think that there's this issue that they talk about called, lead time bias, which is that if you we inherently think this that early detection is like a hugely important goal, but sometimes I think that there is data that now shows that, you know, we don't even know what we're detecting. I mean, to go to the extreme left on this topic, when the National Institutes of Health came out with their active surveillance decision, you know, their review of the evidence, one of the comments they made was, let's not call it cancer. Now, this was something that was very hard for a lot of people to take, but I think that what we're seeing is a lot of people who just things clinically may not have evolved. So you're looking at two different pools of patients. I mean, you're looking at people who may have lethal, aggressive cancers that no matter what you did, there, you know, maybe something might have happened or maybe not. And I do know that for advanced prostate cancer, the treatments are not a picnic. But, you know, if you're taking men where you get all these, so many negative biopsies, and then, you know, there's this whole cycle, I just don't know that, this is a productive way to go. I mean, because we're afraid of which ones are aggressive. I mean, I hope that we get to a point where we can better identify people who are worth screening, but I don't think it's every man.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I just don't think we have enough data. And I mean, there's of course also the thing that, you know, on autopsy you're going to find prostate cancer in cells that may have had nothing to do with the death, and that's fairly frequent.
Right. Yeah, that's the idea that I believe there was studies done that there's at death that in autopsies that there's often found prostate cancers that have had nothing to do with the cause of death, and so that for many men the argument goes that their likelihood of getting prostate cancer as they get older is increasing. It's something that definitely increases with age, but they're probably going to die of something else before that happens, and that's kind of also oversimplifying the what the task force says. My question came up, and when I read that, that was also echoed in one of the papers that the American College of Physicians statement about this, and that is that there is this other issue. All right, let's say you never die of prostate cancer, but you go ahead and develop metastasis or urinary obstruction or other problems. Those could be fairly uncomfortable things to live with if the early screening could have caused some prevention. Again, they didn't specifically answer that. They were looking at death rate versus complications. But I think, in my mind, that's something that's still out there that's a little bothersome, as well as this, if we really knew which tumor was going to be really aggressive, then there would be some potential perhaps for the PSA screening in a different light. And I'm not an expert, but that's just how my mind was working with this. Bill, comment?
Well, I think that's certainly one of the issues, and one of the problems I have, again, with their the basis of their recommendations are that the harms were not addressed at all in the patients that did not have treatment, and the and their definition of asymptomatic versus symptomatic men looked only at the patients who had PSA, and so a number of men have erectile dysfunction, have voiding dysfunction, without having cancer as well, and as that cancer progresses, those become much more troublesome. And specifically, looking at death rate or death and survival as their only measure is a very, I think, short-sighted lifestyle outcome measure without being fair across the board.
All right, we're about halfway through, and I really want to try to encourage our listeners to give us a call as well. I think we've fleshed out some of the major issues, the recommendations, the reasons for the recommendations, as well as some concerns that exist. So let me take our break here and remind everyone we're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection in Anchorage. Our local number is 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. Our email address, line1@alaskapublic.org. Please give us a call or write us an email if you've got questions. And after this break, we'll continue to take these calls and emails if we were to get some, as we talk with Laura Newman, a New York-based medical reporter, and Anchorage urologist Dr. Bill Clark. You're listening to Line 1, and I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard.
You're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection on KSKA Anchorage. If you missed part of today's program or would like to listen again to Line 1, Your Health Connection, the program repeats tonight at 7 on FM 91.1. Remember, tonight's rebroadcast is recorded and will not be taking phone calls. You can subscribe to free podcasts of Line 1, Your Health Connection on our website at alaskapublic.org. This is KSKA Anchorage.
Welcome back. You're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection, and I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. Our topic today is the newest recommendations of the United States Preventive Health Services Task Force on Prostate Screening. My guest by telephone is Laura Newman, a New York-based medical reporter, writer, and editor. And she has also dealt extensively with some urologic problems. And our otherwise, and in the studio is Anchorage urologist Dr. Bill Clark. If you have questions or comments, you can email them to us at line1@alaskapublic.org. You can give us a call at 550-8433. Our outside toll-free number is 1-888-353-5752. And again, I want to remind everybody to go to our website, alaskapublic.org, to pick up some links to help you follow this better, this story better, and also to remind you that if you're listening between 7 and 8, we can't take your phone calls or emails because that's a recorded message. Nathan, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
I was just curious. I didn't know about the urine test to look at specific antigens in that, but I knew about the PSA, obviously. And I'm curious why is there no test, or could there be a test developed that looked at the product of the prostate through investigating seminal fluid or essentially ejaculate, since that's as I understand it produced in the prostate.
Well, that's definitely one of the things that we've been trying to come up with across the board, some sort of other test. And the problem so far, there hasn't been anything that's been identifiable that's held up to any kind of a population study. And I think what happens is the majority of the seminal fluid is actually produced in the seminal vesicle outside the prostate. And I think that's been a contamination that makes it difficult for the testing really to show any good data for recommendation as far as treatment or whether or not a cancer is actually present.
I think it's true that there are very few, if maybe any, cancers where that, you know, that ideal that you're talking about, Nathan, would be wonderful if we have a specific test that says, yep, boom, there's a cancer, and it's specific, that test is specific for that and also sensitive enough to pick it up. I think there's very few of those tests actually have been developed despite lots of effort.
Got it. Well, thank you.
You bet. All right. Let's take another call. Brian, you're on line one.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I was going in for annual screenings for using the PSA tests that are available, and they watched it kind of jump up after a couple of years, and I was placed on Avodart to reduce the size of the prostate, and then that brought the number down, and then it went back up again. They brought me in for a 12-point biopsy and didn't find anything at that point and said, we'll see you back in 6 months. At that point, I switched to a different urologist, and they said, no, we don't need to do a PSA in 6 months. Come back in a year, and we'll take a look at how things are going. So what happens after that negative, and what kind of cycle do you get into?
Okay.
Well, PSA and velocity is one of the things we certainly look at as far as being able to determine a change in the pathology or the biology of the prostate. Avodart is, I think, a very good drug, and actually had a whole other topic looking at prostate cancer prevention. But at any rate, the Avodart is designed to reduce the prostate enlargement, or the we call BPH portion of the prostate pathology, and not to interfere with or change cancer diagnosis. The problem is that it does change the PSA, and therefore you have to establish a new baseline, and you end up drawing more PSAs to be able to do that. It has been still a controversial issue as far as how to manage PSAs after Avodart, but generally a rising PSA after being on a steady dose of Avodart has been more suggestive of a cancer, and some people believe it might be a diagnostic tool to determine who has more just prostate enlargement versus cancer without doing a biopsy.
Brian's question, if I can step in, is what about now he's had a biopsy that was negative? How do you have enough information to suggest how he would be managed now? How often and what would be done?
Well, most would recommend every 4 to 6 months another PSA to follow that velocity and what we call the PSA doubling time.
Mm-hmm.
And a PSA doubling time, if you look at those surveillance protocols, a PSA doubling time of 9 to 12 months or less, especially if you already have a diagnosis of cancer, would mean the equivalent of prostate death within 3 to 3.5 years. The Avidar study is still sort of ongoing, so I can't tell you exactly what those numbers would be, but certainly the more numbers you put on that chart, and especially continuing with the Avidar.
Right. So Brian, if I were to editorialize, I'm going to ask Bill to jump in here. So there's a number of factors that affect PSA. Please keep that in mind. And Avidar would be one. When you collect the specimen related to sexual intercourse can be important. Trauma, a recent infection in the prostate could raise it. So consistently rapidly rising would be bothersome. A single point data may or may not be as important. Further biopsies don't sound like they're on the agenda if, according to what you're saying, Bill, if the PSA behaves itself.
That's true.
True or false?
That velocity that you're finding. Yeah. Another alternative would be what the FDA actually approved the PCA3 or that urine-based biopsy for, was patients that have a rising PSA in spite of a negative biopsy. If that PSA number or that PCA3 value would keep rising, then the likelihood of a cancer, but also a more aggressive cancer, would be the case.
Okay. All right, Laura, I don't mean to keep you out of there. We got into kind of a detailed medical issue.
Well,
comments?
I think, when you have a doctor on the show, people want answers.
You betcha. But your comments are welcome, though. Please.
Well, one thing that concerns me is that, you know, sometimes I just wonder whether, you know, I think that there are, as I understand it, I mean, there's sort of a time to take a PSA, and, you know, if there's inflammation or et cetera, things going on, if somebody had EPH, let's not turn this into a, the overlap with prostate cancer, I'm dubious about. I mean, I'm just sort of skeptical about men. I've heard stories of men suddenly going into this cascade of all this testing that maybe it just somebody should have taken a step back.
Yeah. Yeah, and what's the hurry kind of thing? And we don't have, to be honest, I think, as I understand it, again, Bill, I'm going to defer to both of you. We don't have that test that really says, hey, well, the biopsy missed it, or this is going to be a real aggressive. We'd all love to have that that information. It would drive us a little bit differently. But we've got clinical judgment, and we've got experience, and we've got this PSA and maybe a doubling time and maybe this new urine test.
Well, actually, I think how the task force looked at the two PRIME studies that they based their recommendations on is, I think, bears some explanation. The U.S. study was actually touted as being a screening study, meaning you had patients who didn't have PSA and the other group did have PSA. Well, it turns out that it wasn't actually that. It was a group that had already been pre-screened, so 40% of those had actually had PSAs done before they started the study.
Mm-hmm.
The second is that the non-PSA group was actually what we call usual care, and over almost 50, I think between 50 and 60% of that group actually got PSAs as their standard of care, so they were not actually non-PSA patients. So the we call contamination in the study was significant in that, to be able to really determine that. And the third thing with that is that there was set up to be a 7-year statistical significant study to reach statistical significance, and they stopped the study at just short of 6 years, which was a little bit troublesome for some of the science-based people. The European study was a more pure study. Those folks actually had less than, I think, than 15% contamination, so that it was more true that the non-PSA group didn't get PSAs. But the follow-on with that, which was just published now at 13 years, which the task force decided they didn't want to review the new data. But at any rate, that showed a 44% reduction in prostate cancer death at the average of 13 years, which actually is a significant difference.
Mm-hmm. So Bill's, for the listeners, Bill's arguing again that it's very, very difficult to do a perfect study that is large enough, controlled enough, that's not going to have confounding variables, and that's where some wiggle room exists among those who are skeptical that this is the right advice for everybody. Brian, did we get your question answered well enough?
You did. I have one follow-up, if I can, and that's really focusing on the difference of opinion between two different urologists
right.
about how to proceed.
Right.
What's the basis for that? I mean, you walk in and
right.
you're relying
right.
on the specialist to tell you what direction to go.
Well, I think that is one of the problems in the present day. We don't absolutely know. I mean, there wouldn't be this controversy if we knew the answers. And I think that's the reason we need to continue these studies, and they are continuing, which is the best news, is that I think we'll have even more data as it accumulates. But there isn't a right answer, and that's one of the problems you have to kind of go with what I think discussion between the patient and the specialist as to, you know, what your comfort level is in making those determinations.
Yeah, Brian, I think I would encourage you to at least certainly read these recommendations carefully. I think the more you have information, and then the better you can discuss the differences between these recommendations, the better. I don't think Laura or Dr. Clark or myself, I mean, each person's got a little bit different study, you know, different situation, your age, your family history of prostate cancer, your race. There's a lot of factors that do come into play here, which also contribute to maybe perhaps some of the differences in recommendations that you're getting.
And some of the symptoms, I think,
and
as well.
Symptoms, yeah.
Thank you for the show.
All right. Wish we could be more specific. That's often the case, though. All right. Michael, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
Thanks for taking my call. I've got briefly, my dad was diagnosed in 1989 with prostate cancer, and his PSA was through the roof. He went through a variety of treatments that included radiation therapy, radical prostatectomy, an orchiectomy, and now he's in his sixth year of chemotherapy after being diagnosed 23 years ago. And my brother, who's 4 years older than me, was diagnosed at 65. My dad was also diagnosed at 65, and he underwent prostatectomy. It seems to me, with my family history, it's going to be very important for me to have a PSA, which I do faithfully at least once a year, sometimes twice a year. It's kind of confusing to hear all this stuff. I'm just wondering, with my family history, it seems almost incumbent that I continue to do PSAs on at least a yearly basis. Is that right?
Well, that would be at least the American Urologic Association's position. The task force did not feel it was indicated in any individual based on race or family history. And one of the things they also look at is Agent Orange exposure in Vietnam. That's one of our problems, is making such a universal grade D recommendation across the board is, to me, troublesome.
Laura,
I thought that there was room for individualizing. Screening is really a population recommendation, and that there is room for a doctor to discuss with a patient, you know, the pros and the cons and areas of special concern. But I think at the same time, I think the task force would say part of that process is really talking about the risks and the, you know, perhaps unproven benefits of the screening. Otis Brawley, who's at the American Cancer Society, is really skeptical about prostate cancer screening, and he's worked in the field for a long time. And I think he's a physician, and he, I think the point is, how do you inform patients and how do patients really get the best information? I mean, I wish that it's hard to figure out what you're getting when you get a doctor and you they're getting paid by procedures. And, you know, this is not, you know, I don't want to make a crass, attack, but I wish that, and I think this is part of what's happening with health reform, there is a move to pay for health outcomes and value rather than every time somebody does a PSA, a biopsy, a TURP, and all these procedures, you know, the income rises. So I hope that with health reform, we can start looking at that kind of thing, so that it doesn't become something that for urologists it is a loss. It's a loss of income if they don't keep doing this. But you know, I would love to see urologists taking care of the hard kidney cancers that, you know, maybe we don't have physicians as well distributed.
Well, actually, just in the kidney cancer world, the new move is to not treat small renal masses and kidney cancers because some of those don't develop.
I do know that.
And so, I think it's the same in each of the tumors, or different entities for sure.
Michael, your specific question is a really important one, and that does get back that I do think the way I see those recommendations is it's clearly open for individuals to talk with their physicians, probably best urologists in a specific situation about, are you going to do a PSA, when are you going to do it, and then how are you going to use those results. And that depends a lot on factors we've mentioned already, including the strong family history. So if I put myself in your situation, I would be wanting to know specifically as much as I can about surveillance. It's another issue to act on what those surveillance is, and that's where, you know, perhaps you may need to get talk to more than one urologist sometimes and get different opinions about it.
Well, I think the other thing is the initial statement which the task force put out, which does give it the grade D recommendation, also comes with a disclaimer further down, which in quotes from the from their statement is that it recognizes that clinical decisions involve more considerations than evidence alone, and clinicians should understand the evidence but individualize decision making to the specific patient or situation.
Right.
So I think something that...
Yeah, the public would often like to have science as absolutely absolute. We know absolute right and wrong, and that's rarely the situation. We get better and better and better at approximating what may be truth. And Michael, you're kind of caught in that situation. You're going to have to make your best decision after talking and understanding as much as you can. It's part of the reason for the program is to help people understand some of the issues and what's going on. So hopefully this has helped a little bit.
Yeah, great. I appreciate it. And one other thing, if you could comment a little bit on lifestyle changes or lifestyle influence on prostate cancer, that would be great. Thanks very much.
Yep, thanks for your call. One of you want to comment on lifestyle changes, what from a preventative standpoint or from a, once you've got a high PSA?
Well, from my standpoint, those are the holy grail. I mean, certainly rather than having to worry about treatment or diagnosis, being able to prevent it across the board. And certainly there are some very impressive lifestyle changes that sort of go along with breast cancer as well. Unfortunately, our obesity epidemic has seemed to cause either some sort of an inflammatory response that seems to set up either a promotion or a advancement of prostate cancer. There's a diabetes association as well. Prostate cancer seems to be higher in smokers. So basically the things that are, and cholesterol as well, so lipid panels and such are important. So it appears that things that are, in general terms, things that are good for your heart are going to be good for your prostate, both in cancer and in prostate enlargement.
So nothing magical or easy. You just eat, lose weight, get a good BMI, waist to height thing has also been looked at, and exercise. We didn't
absolutely
mention exercise.
Exercise
has been shown to be
as well.
Laura, anything we're not thinking about?
I guess I'm not sure. I think that, I do think that people, as much as you can talk to a urologist, you have to realize where a urologist is coming from, and that, there is a whole culture, and, if you ask a surgeon what to do, a surgeon will say treat to some extent. So I sort of think that if I were in the situation, and obviously prostate is not my particular thing, I would try to talk to patients who have gone through this one way or another. I found on my own blog, patientpov.org, there when I write about prostate cancer, we see this huge diversity of opinion. There are people who feel that their father was saved by a radical prostatectomy. There are people who feel that they went through a whole lot of stuff and, they're miserable or that they're not really sure they had anything. So I think that it's really getting at your own preferences and your comfort with, there's uncertainty and about benefit. So, and harm, and I think that it really the same thing, just like urologists run the gamut from, being wonderful to who knows what, I think patients have different levels of comfort with treating or not treating, wanting to be evaluated up the wazoo, and societally, I just don't know that we can really afford to just, give services to people when there's so much controversy about the, where it's taking us.
Yep. All right. We got getting close to the end here a little bit. Nicole, I would like to take your call, though. How are you doing? What can we do for you?
Oh, good. Thank you for taking my call. I was just hoping you could address false positives in the PSA test. I've read in the European clinical trial that of men who underwent biopsy for the elevated PSA, 76% had a false positive test. What would you advise for somebody who's on the borderline, and how would you address that?
Well, my feeling is that one of the problems with both of those trials was that they used an arbitrary number of 4.0 as being a breakpoint for doing a biopsy. And I think that a lot of us are much less comfortable with an absolute number. So being, and that's one of the reasons I think screenings are probably not an unreasonable thing at all, to be able to establish during a relatively younger time what your normal PSA is, and a deviation from that, whether it be 4.0 or not, or 3.5, and seeing a change from whatever your baseline is probably the more important factor for triggering a biopsy. But also looking at different things that can influence that. We see up here mountain bike riding or things with four-wheeling or snow machining, I can tell you will make PSAs rise dramatically. And I think you have to use some judgment before you go on to a biopsy being performed rather than taking an arbitrary number, which is what, unfortunately, the studies mandated.
The way the studies were done. Does that make sense, Nicole?
I do think the false positive rate is kind of alarming. I mean, I have read that the positive predictive value of a PSA over 4 is about 30%, meaning that, just 1 in 3 men who have that are going to be found to have a prostate cancer on biopsy. Right. So it does make you wonder, what else you're going to feel. You're going to be feeling like I'm being worked up for cancer.
Yeah, well, I think
you're going to go through the procedure. And
I think that's what Bill's actually saying, is that the problem is those studies did use that cutoff. And in real life, many urologists don't use that single thing. They're looking at the family history, the whole bunch, and maybe rate, and maybe you do one. And I can tell you from a personal experience, I had a very high prostate PSA on a screening, but I know I had had a prostatitis a little bit before that, and waited and did another one, and it was back to normal, and that was several years ago. So the issue is that the single line in the sand can lead to a lot of false positives, and that may not be the best way. And unfortunately, these studies were based on that, and that's one of the problems with doing the right science. Is the science is, you know, what we're doing is moving. So no arguments. Maybe a PSA of 159 would be treated a little different than some other numbers. But drawing a single study leading to biopsies might not be the right thing. Although again, it has to be individualized. And it sounds like there's very little harm. Bill, you're the clinician here. If you have a single positive that's high, in waiting a little bit and seeing what's happened to it over time, there's not a lot of risk to waiting and repeating. Is that worthwhile saying?
No, I think that's the feeling in the majority of the urology world right now.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Sorry for butting. I hope that answered your question, Nicole. We are actually in our last 2 minutes here, and I really like each person to have just a brief second to make some comments. Laura, you said something just a minute ago. I'm going to ask Bill if he's got any final comments, then I'll come back to you if we've got the time, Laura.
Well, I think that I'd like to be able to reiterate that I think prostate-specific antigen is still a very valuable tool, and I think one of the other things that we argue back and forth about screening versus case finding and lead time bias, et cetera. But I think that confusion between that and how we use it to manage patients with prostate cancer as well is one of the important things. But I think still being able to have that as an option for folks, and I think anytime you make a broad statement that covers everybody and everything is difficult to substantiate.
Okay. Laura?
Well, I think that, there are issues that, we haven't even scratched the surface here with, and I think this is, again, PSA, came about and was embraced and for a long time, and I do think that people may want to, consider the data. I think we're biased in this nation, in this country, to do things. And I think it, even looking at different cultures and looking at the health outcomes might be very informative for listeners.
Okay. Well, thanks very much. I also had an email from an epidemiologist reminding us that we ought to look at the whole principle of screening. You might want to look that up on the internet. I'm sorry we didn't get a time to do that. And often in any screening, we're going to want to find more false positive than false negatives because we don't want to miss issues. So there's a lot of issues here, as has already been stated. Laura, thanks very much. Bill, thanks very much for taking the time. I appreciate it. Next week, we're going to return, and we're going to do something a little different. I'm going to open up the phones and email so you can ask me directly some questions and comments about various problems. I'll try to do my best to answer them and give you my opinion. So why not to write down your questions and think about sending them in or calling next Monday, July 16th. Pat Yeck is Vice President of Public Media. Kristen Spack is our web editor and our audio engineer today. Thanks for everyone who listened and made comments. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
Line 1, Your Health Connection is a production of Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect KSKA.org. CD copies can be purchased by calling fine@alaskapublic.org. CD copies can be purchased by calling 550-8400. This is KSKA Anchorage.